Drive Time 91.3. Always on the cutting edge. Welcome back to Voice of the Cape, Drive Time. We picked up a story in the English media of all places, in fact a tabloid, which says how ISIS is going against Islam's teachings. Text suggests Muslim prophet wanted Christians to be protected and defended. This is according to our guest, Dr. Craig Considine, lecturer in the Department of Sociology at Rice University in Houston, Texas. As a sociologist, Dr. Considine focuses on Christian-Muslim relations, religious pluralism, Islam, Muslims in America, Christian-Muslim relations, interfaith studies, race, ethnicity, identity, as well as comparative research and ethnography. It certainly is a very, very big plate. But Dr. Craig Considine, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Shafiq. It's nice to be here.
You certainly have a wide variety of interests. As I said, it's a big plate, isn't it?
It is indeed. There's a lot in this world that we need to improve, and we oftentimes see religion and topics like Islam and race and ethnicity all intersecting. So we have to consider all of these angles when we talk about issues, particularly pertaining to Islam and Muslims.
Now, what is interesting, we picked up on some research that you'd done in an English newspaper which is known for its tabloidism. And the headline that it's using is how ISIS is going against Islam's teachings. Now, first of all, are you surprised to hear that your research has popped up in an English tabloid?
Yeah, that kind of caught me off guard. It was first picked up by The Independent, which is another English newspaper, and I think there was some type of domino effect, and it ended up in, yeah, the Daily Mail, which I think most people that are familiar with this tabloid, they usually connect it with more of the kind of Islamophobic rhetoric. So I suppose it was actually a pleasant surprise to see them giving attention to an issue that actually combats Islamophobia.
Now, the research that you've done, obviously, we all know that most classical scholars of Islam who don't get to appear in the Daily Mail or even the Independent sometimes would agree with your research that the codicil of Islam right from the beginning was coexistence. It wasn't cutting off people's heads because they had a different faith.
No, and that's absolutely correct. And the documents that I analyzed, they're generally identified as the covenants of Prophet Muhammad with the Christians of his time. And these documents are really sending a message which is the polar opposite of the actions and messages being sent out by groups like ISIS, which is operating in the Middle East right now in a completely intolerant and exclusionary nature. And I really do believe that if Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was with us today, he would absolutely condone their actions.
Now, sorry, you would condemn rather than condone.
Excuse me, condemn. Thank you for that correction.
All right, we don't want the Daily Mail on our cases, do we?
No, you don't want that. Yes, condemn. Let me be very clear, condemn. Thank you. It's early in the morning here.
Not a problem. Dr. Considine, of course, you say you looked at many texts, but I'm sure you'll agree that probably one of the most profound ones is a text that's found at Mount Sinai at the monastery there, which explicitly guarantees the monks of that particular monastery protection from Muslims. And I do believe that document is actually still there.
Yes, indeed. The document is still there. And it was actually covered a few years ago by 60 Minutes, which is a prominent weekly program in the United States. And one of the top American journalists went to the monastery and spent time with one of the fellows in the actual monastery, and the document is there. And this is the covenant with the monks of Mount Sinai is one of a handful of these documents. And these are original texts, and the monks have a long history of passing down the authenticity of this particular document.
It's amazing to think. I mean, this document still surviving. It's more than 1,400 years old. I mean, that is old.
It is quite old, and there is an issue that should be addressed, and that is that that text particularly is was replicated by the Ottoman Empire because the text, as you mentioned, is over 1,000 years old, and the original text was crumbling away. So it's actually a duplicate, but the monks at Mount Sinai agree that it is an authentic document. It was just replicated from the original.
Right. Now, what other sources were you able to access in coming to this conclusion that in terms of Christianity and Islam, it's about coexistence, it's about cohabitation, it's not about antagonism? What other sort of sources were you able to dig up?
Sure. Well, I looked deeply into the Quran in Hadiths, and I was focusing on the term, which is a popular term, Alal Kitab. So the idea that Christians and Jews are people of the book. So with that understanding, the covenants and the message of the covenants of respect and protection makes sense, because Prophet Muhammad, when he was receiving his revelations, was not simply creating this new faith, right? So he was building off of previous traditions through Christianity and Judaism. So I looked deeply into the Quran, I looked deeply into the Hadiths, and the paper itself. I also problematized other issues that people in the Islamophobic industry like to pick up. So this idea of like dhimmi status, this idea of Christians being forced to pay the jizya, which some people would argue is mandated by the Quran. The actual covenants themselves, they do suggest that Christians pay a jizya, but Prophet Muhammad is also quite clear in saying that if the jizya is going to impose some type of hardship on the Christian communities, then they should be relieved of paying the jizya. So I looked deeply into the Quran, deeply into the Hadith, and other historic Islamic documents such as the Constitution of Medina, which is a pact between Muslims and Jews. And this pact had a similar type of feeling of democracy, of respect, of coexistence that we see in the covenants too.
Is what comes profoundly out of these documents the fact that there is no absolutism, that all these covenants, as you've already inferred, are never quite black and white, that they always leave room for a bit of mercy, as it were?
Absolutely. And what I actually argue in the paper is that the covenants themselves are actually going beyond what we generally understand to be religious tolerance. So if we take that term and we try to unpack it, it suggests a level of respect indeed, but it's also kind of suggesting that religious communities, to each his own, right? So religious communities can live as they want, they can abide by the laws that they want to, and the government will respect that. But the covenants are actually calling on Muslims and Christians to engage in pluralism. So pluralism is going a step further than tolerance. Pluralism is calling on Christians and Muslims to actively engage with one another, to meet each other, to have dialogue with one another. And the covenants are talking about calling on Muslims to repair Christian churches. If a Christian church is somehow dilapidated or in ruin, it's upon the Muslims, it's their duty as Muslims to help those Christians rebuild their places of worship. So I think we need to understand that there's an important step from tolerance to pluralism. And I think ideally we need to encourage people of all faiths to promote more dialogue, to actively engage with each other, because that's where true bonds and true friendships happen.
Something that is profound to me out of your research and some of these documents is that one party doesn't assume superiority over another. I'm sure you'll agree a lot of interfaith dialogue sort of stops in its tracks, because one party will call for a dialogue on the assumption that the party calling for the dialogue is somehow superior to the other one. Your comment on that?
Well, I think that's the ultimate issue with interfaith dialogue, right? So usually the issue there is that you only get people that that are interested in meeting everyone on the same level. And certainly, as you mentioned, Shafiq, that people come with their own levels of superiority, and you get into the area of hierarchies, right? So some religious groups are more authoritative than others. But what we see in the covenants, in light of what Prophet Muhammad was envisioning for an Islamic state, he was suggesting that being a member of the Ummah was basically bent on citizenship, just as we see with the notion of citizenship in the United States. Anyone can be an American citizen. It doesn't matter what religion you are, what ethnic or racial background you are. You are protected by the state through civic rights, through citizenship rights. And I truly believe my interpretation of the text is that's what Muhammad was calling for. The Ummah is not simply a place for Muslims only. There is space for Christians and Jews and even atheists, idol worshippers. That's my interpretation of the text. It's bent on citizenship.
In fact, in a sense, it ties up with the opinion of the famous Imam Jalaluddin Suyuti, who wrote that heaven itself would not be the exclusive domain of Muslims, that there was as much room for other faiths as there would be for Islam. Something that wouldn't be very popular with our friends in ISIS today, wouldn't it?
That's absolutely correct. And I think an important issue to raise with a group like ISIS and their polar opposites, which would be people who are adopting more of the Islamophobic rhetoric and this idea that, you know, Islam is inherently violent and exclusionary, all false accusations. And I think it's interesting because these two kind of poles are using the same type of rhetoric, this idea that my way is better and everyone that doesn't agree with my way of thinking is somehow inferior to me. And I don't think there's anything in terms of the scholarship that is coming out of Prophet Muhammad's legacy that would agree with that. I mean, you have Quranic verses that are calling for there to be no compulsion in religion. I mean, this is a very profound point. This is a point and a verse that is echoing the importance of religious freedom and religious liberty. And I think this is really the crux of what Prophet Muhammad's vision was.
Yeah, in the sense that we were made to know each other and not despise each other.
That's right. And Shafiq, you raise an important point. And there's another Quranic verse which says that God created mankind in different tribes and different cultures and different religions so we can get to know one another. And that's a real challenge. That is a challenge that the Quran is saying is passed down from God. And it's upon us as human beings to engage with one another, to dialogue with one another, to engage in that pluralism, which is essential to create friendships and bonds between people.
As a matter of interest, when you talk to the greater public, as it were, about the concepts of pluralism that we're discussing here, how does it go down in a place like the United States, where from the outside we see a lot of Islamophobia, particularly from the mouths of people like Donald Trump, and of course it's a presidential election, and these kind of statements seem to be hyped up at this particular time. What's the reception, though, when you introduce your discourse into this whole scenario?
It's challenging for people, Shafiq, and I think the reason why it's challenging is a few things. One, we do have the impact of the media. So the media generally tends to only show the worst sides of humanity. So in a way, people are led to believe that an idea like religious pluralism is not possible because they see the actions of ISIS and they say there's no way that Muslims are going to want to interact. So that's problem number one. Problem number two, and this is supported by various polls that have been published over the last 2 or 3 years, the number of Americans that have actually never met a Muslim or interacted with a Muslim is quite high. I don't know the precise figure, but it's certainly above 60%. And I think this is the real issue, and it goes back to the importance of pluralism. You know, how can Americans come to conclusions about Muslims, Muslim Americans, or the Islamic faith in general if they've actually never interacted with people? So when I call on people to engage in pluralism, it kind of comes out of nowhere to them because they have no exposure to Muslim communities. They don't visit mosques. They don't have Muslim friends. So again, what we need to do is create more exposure for people that that actually don't have it. So it's more interfaith dialogue and cross-cultural communications that is needed.
Do you enjoy a measure of satisfaction when your message does get home? Because I'm sure there are times when it does.
Yeah, I would like for it to be more of a positive feedback. I also get a lot of messages from Muslims and non-Muslims suggesting that I'm engaging in some type of propaganda and I'm lying about my research. But certainly there is hope. There are people all around the world that, you know, send messages and saying, you know, continue on the fight of building bridges between religious communities. So it's a dicey realm, I suppose, that I've entered in terms of my scholarship. It's a controversial subject, and it's sensitive because it challenges people to really think deeply about terms that have kind of been hijacked, like Prophet Muhammad and Islam. These terms have really been hijacked by the media, and I suppose it's on me to kind of, me and my colleagues and others, to kind of crack away slowly but surely at the level of misunderstanding.
On a personal level, I mean, what inspired or motivated you to start looking into these things at an academic level?
Well, I'm a product of 9/11. I remember when 9/11 happened, 15 years old. To make a long story short, I remember school was canceled and there were students walking around in the hallways saying some pretty awful things, death to Muslims and, you know, just generally bad things that I can't say on the radio. And, you know, to be honest, I kind of fell into that rhetoric, into that trap. I was 15, 16 years old, and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq started to kick off. And I was interested in understanding this term that President Bush threw out, which is why do they hate us? Okay, so I was going with this idea, let me study the people that supposedly hate us. So I went to college and I took a class on Islam, and I entered that class thinking, okay, I'm going to figure out what's going on here in a kind of negative light. And my professor, his name's Akbar Ahmed of American University, the first thing he said in class was, it was a popular hadith of the Prophet Muhammad, the ink of the scholar is more sacred than the blood of the martyr. And when he said that to me, it completely shook the framework that I understood Muslims and Islam and Prophet Muhammad in. And I kind of went with that more hopeful message, because it's really suggesting that knowledge and education is more important than martyrdom. So I just went with it. And the more I studied, the more I learned of the commonalities between the faiths, and the more I engaged with the research, the more I realized how deeply embedded Islamophobia and racism is in the United States and the American public. So a lot of it is rooted in just trying to build bridges and trying to counter the narrative that is just detrimental to mankind. This idea of us versus them, and we can't mutually coexist. That's my motive, really.
Dr. Craig Considine, lecturer at the Department of Sociology at Rice University in Houston, Texas. We picked up, ironically, some of his research that appeared in the tabloid newspaper in England, in which he points out how ISIS goes against Islamic teachings, and of course his views based on a number of texts that the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, wanted Christians, for example, to be protected and defended, and that Muslims had to live in harmony with them at all levels in a sense of pluralistic tolerance. Dr. Craig Considine, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you, and all of the best in grading your papers.
Thank you, Shafiq. It was a real pleasure. Hope to talk to you again.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Drive Time 91.3. Always on the cutting edge.